We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Disgust is one of the most basic human emotions. It seems to be something that almost everyone, everywhere, has experienced. Certainly if you show around a photograph of someone making that face of disgust, everyone, adults, children, will know what that all means. Interestingly enough, though, the list of potentially disgusting things is rather varied, which brings us to the question, well, truly, what's happening when we feel disgust? Now, that is the subject that will be taken up this afternoon in a talk on the U of I campus by the guest that we have with us here this morning, Colin McGinn from the Department of Philosophy at University of Miami. He is here to give a talk. This is a talk in the MillerCom series. It's the Philosophy Annual Public Lecture, and he'll be talking on the topic disgust and death this afternoon, 4 o'clock at the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on the campus. It's on South Gregory in Urbana. These events are always open to the public and free. Anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. This morning, we'll perhaps talk a little bit about that, but more generally about the field of philosophy. And our guest Colin McGinn has written widely in philosophy. Now, much of this might be challenging for people who are not in the field. But if you're interested in something that explores some basic issues in philosophy and also says something about how it is one comes to this field, one book that you might look at is his book, The Making of a Philosopher, My Journey Through 20th Century Philosophy. That's the subtitle, and it's published by HarperCollins. Otherwise, questions here are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and you may email your comments and questions to will-talk, just like it sounds, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being
here. Thank you. Yes, I'm glad to be here.
I thought it might be interesting to start this way and to talk a little bit about philosophy as an enterprise, because I think that probably most people would say that they wouldn't really understand how philosophy, what philosophers do, would connect to them and some of the basic problems they encounter in their life as they get from one day to the next. What does philosophy have to say about real life?
I think not too much, actually, about real life. Philosophy is a very big subject with many departments in it. Mm-hmm. You know, it started off with the ancient Greeks, with Socrates and Plato, and then Aristotle, and that sort of set the foundations and the scope of philosophy was set at that time. So, if you look at the work of Aristotle, for example, who wrote many books, they were across a very wide range of topics. So he originated symbolic logic. People know about the syllogism. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. So that part of philosophy is about formalizing deductive inference, and that was an example of a deductive inference. And so Aristotle invented the syllogism to do that. Does it have very much to do with ordinary life? Not particularly, because people can reason validly without Aristotle coming along and formalizing the way they reason. But it's useful for people to learn the formal rules, because there are various fallacies you can fall into when you're reasoning, and so it's useful. But the primary interest of it is not as a sort of self-help guide to people in their ordinary reasoning. It's a theoretical investigation. So Aristotle was interested in physics, the nature of motion, much the same interest that a physicist would have. So there's no, and if we ask, well, what's the relevance of physics, theoretical physics, to a person's ordinary decisions? Not very much. It's a theoretical enterprise. Of course, there's applied physics. Philosophy of biology he was interested in, the nature of purpose. So there are many departments. One of the departments which is closer to people's ordinary interests is ethics, and Aristotle made very significant contributions to that. So that's the question of how one should act, what is a good agent, what's virtue. I think many people who hear the word philosophy think that philosophy is mainly about that subject, But in fact, that's just a small part of it's an important part of philosophy, but it's a small part. And there are other parts which are much more abstract and more like theoretical science. But I think in the case of ethics, certain parts of ethics, not all of ethics, are very much applied subjects. And those things are interesting to people because people are interested in, for example, you know, is euthanasia morally acceptable? Is abortion morally acceptable? Under what circumstances might killing somebody be acceptable? Theft? And so on. So that there's a part of it that's of interest to people. But I would say, you know, I don't want to give false advertising to philosophy. Philosophy is a theoretical subject, and philosophers are people motivated by theoretical interests. Certainly isn't like psychology or anything like that.
Now that you mentioned psychology, maybe I'll ask a question about you, because I believe that you actually began studying psychology and moved into the field of philosophy.
I did.
Maybe I would ask about what prompted your interest in psychology and then what prompted the move from one to the other.
Yeah. Well, when I was at school, I was wondering what to study at university, and I thought it would be sensible to do something where I could, you know, gain employment afterwards. And so originally I applied to study economics, a very, very solid subject. And I studied economics at school, and I was quite good at economics. But it didn't really thrill me too much as a subject. You know, I could do it, and I was sort of interested, but it didn't excite me. And then I read Sigmund Freud at that time, and I found him very stimulating. You know, I read some of his main texts, and so maybe the sex was interesting to me too in there, and the idea of everything was explicable in terms of sex was interesting. But I liked the way Freud was trying to peel back the surface appearances to get to the underlying realities, and so that things which appeared to be a certain way actually turns out not to be that way, and there's a much deeper truth there. I think that's what really primarily appealed to me. So I decided I would study psychology because I liked Freud's discussions of psychopathology. I was interested in that kind of issue, madness and neurosis and so on, which Freud was dealing with. And also I had a bit of interest in educational psychology. Anyway, I went to university to study psychology, thinking, well, I'll become an educational psychologist at the end, or maybe a clinical psychologist. So it also had a vocational side to it. But really my interest was in the more abstract questions. And when I started studying psychology, I had two lectures on Freud in the 3 years that I was studying it, so it wasn't what I was expecting. You know, we had physiological psychology, we had statistics, we had intelligence tests, we had experimental psychology and so on. And I was interested in some of it, but I was always a little bit more interested in the more abstract questions. And then part of my degree requirements were that I'd study a subsidiary philosophy course. So the first one I did was about Plato and Sartre, and it was a comparison between Sartre's existentialism and Plato's universal essentialism. And that interested me, and I got interested in philosophy of science, too, through that. And so as I progressed, I really felt during my second, third year of being an undergraduate that I really would, if I really was more interested in philosophical issues. So then I had to switch. So I switched as a graduate student to philosophy. I went to Oxford. It was quite tough to do that. And then I became interested very much in analytic philosophy, metaphysics, epistemology, philosophy of mind, and so on. And I never looked back then. So that's what I knew I wanted to do. And I've been doing that now for 35 years. I've been a professor, and I'm very glad that I made that choice because that's what I was interested in. But I felt, I mean, for all those young people out there who may be like me when I was young, and they're afraid of going into a subject like this because it doesn't seem practical, you know, you can actually have a perfectly good life as a professor of philosophy. It's a nice life, you know. You get paid, it's enjoyable, you have long vacations, and you're enjoying yourself, you know.
Well, the thing, it strikes me what brings together perhaps what Freud was trying to do and what a lot of philosophers had tried to do. The thing that maybe they have in common is that the basic tools of what they were doing was right, you know, this tissue that's right in between their ears. I mean, essentially, that's what it is. It's using the product of their own minds, thinking about the products of other people's minds. And Freud was, of course, very interested in myth and religion and literature and history and, you know, all of the written record of human experience, taking that and trying to work with it.
Yeah.
And that it's all that you, to do your work, you carry the tools around with you all the time.
Yeah. It's the power of reasoning. You see in Freud, you do see the ability of reason to think through a range of subject matter. You don't have to do lots of experiments, you know, it's a theoretical task. You've got the data there and you're trying to develop a theoretical system that unifies various fields. That's one of the things that Freud did. So Freud famously unified dreams, neurosis, jokes, and other things too, and it, under one theoretical umbrella. So we know, in that case, we don't need to experiment on dreams. We know what dreams are, and we develop theories about them. So philosophers use unaided reason. They're thinking about questions where you're not just trying to find out what the facts are about something, which a scientist might do. You're trying to get a theory of at the most abstract level of what things. For example, I'll give you an example, so it's easier for hearers to understand it. I was very taken as a teenager with the problem of the external world, which is the problem of how you know that there's anything beyond your own sense experiences. It goes back to, well, not just to Descartes, but it's been around forever. Because, you know, people notice that, of course, it's possible to have sense experiences which are illusory, where you misperceive the environment, or maybe you just conjure into existence something which isn't there at all. Mm-hmm. So that raises the question, well, how do you really know that that's not what's going on all the time? And you know, Descartes had the problem of how do you know that your whole life isn't just a dream? Because in a dream you feel that's reality and you're convinced that that's the way things are. How could you prove that the experience you have when you think you're awake is not a dream? And that raises very troubling questions about knowledge. You know, how do you really know? How do I know that I'm speaking to you now in a studio, not just dreaming I'm having? Because, of course, I could have had a dream last night knowing I'm going to do this interview, but that I'm having a conversation with somebody on radio, and I'm not having that conversation. Mm-hmm. So it raises these questions about knowledge and how, you know, and skepticism. What's the nature of justification? How do you arrive at the truth? Do you really know anything at all? I think a lot of people, especially perhaps in teenagers, you know, at some level start to think about that type of question. Same as the question, how do I know that you have a mind? All I observe about you is your behavior. I sort of guess that you have a mind behind that. But do I really know that? After all, if you didn't, you'd still be behaving the way you do now. So these questions, I mean, they're not, when I say theoretical questions, they're not ones that only, you know, somebody who was a very pedantic and, you know, dry intellect would be interested in. They spring from ordinary experiences. And for some people, they grab, you know, and they find these are very interesting questions that they'd like to think about. And that's what philosophy is about.
Our guest this morning is Colin McGinn. He's professor of philosophy at University of Miami. He's visiting the campus here of the University of Illinois to give talk, the philosophy annual public lecture, the topic Disgust and Death, this afternoon, 4 o'clock on the U of I campus. Anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome to stop by. And here on our program, questions are welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. You also may email your comments and questions to Will, W-I-L-L, will-talk at illinois.edu. We do have someone to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. I've got a listener in Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Yes. Thank you, David. I have two questions. The first is how your guest addresses metaphysics, mysticism, and existentialism.
Large topics. I don't address mysticism because I'm not. I don't find that a very interesting subject or one that I'm sympathetic with those ideas. Metaphysics I'm very interested in, but the word metaphysics now has an unfortunate meaning in contemporary culture. If you go into a bookstore and you go into metaphysics, it's all about, you know, New Ageism and mysticism. When I talk about metaphysics, the word comes from Aristotle. It was a book of his which he wrote after his book called Physics, and it's about questions like causality, necessity, time, space, matter, those kinds of issues. I'm interested in questions like that, but they don't have anything to do with metaphysics in the sense in which many people talk about that, which is some sort of a non-scientific or transcendent religious kind of reality. So I'm not interested in that. Existentialism, I was interested in very much as a student and studied Sartre's book, Being and Nothingness, which is a very interesting but difficult book. And it's basically, you know, his idea is that we suffer from an awareness of our own freedom. And this is the essence of man, is to be free, and the essence of consciousness is to be free. And human life is structured around the angst that arises from the recognition of our own freedom, which is radical in Sartre's view. So I think that's an interesting question. In fact, my talk this afternoon about disgust is in the same philosophical territory as that, and indeed in the same territory as Freud. I'm trying actually to replace existentialism and Freudianism as a theory of the human condition by a theory which focuses on disgust as the most basic human emotion, not angst at freedom and not sex, as in the case of Freud. So I'm very interested in that area of philosophy.
Yes. My second question is, I've nearly finished reading Wilhelm Reich's piece on the mass psychology of fascism.
Mm.
And I'm wondering if you have heard of him.
Mm, I have.
Yes, and I'd like your thoughts on him and his now addressing work democracy, which is not a new topic for me, but it is one that receives very little attention. And I'm wondering if you had read the mass psychology and or your thoughts about Wilhelm Reich.
I haven't read Wilhelm Reich. Of course, he's really a psychologist.
Psychiatrist. A student of Freud.
Exactly. Yeah. Famous more for his work on the, I think, was it called the orgone machine? Anyway, a sex-related subject. So I don't know very much about Reich, except that I've heard of him in that connection. I gather he was a perfectly respectable thinker of the maybe 20s, 30s, but I think not much read these days, maybe, you know, unjustly. Maybe there's something in there that needs to be revived. So I don't have very much to say about Reich. About democracy, I would have a lot more to say. I think that's an interesting subject.
Well, his ideas and work democracy,
yeah,
and having that as a paradigm rather than capitalism, which I, uh-huh, you know, is ruinous and,
yeah,
now aged to a point that it is destructive rather than progressive.
Yeah.
So, well, I thank you very much, sir.
My pleasure.
I'll listen. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions, comments are welcome. Again, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just, I wonder if we could return to the subject that we were talking about before, and I'd realize this is maybe getting into something that one could spend a lot of time talking about. But I think, for example, of many of the criticisms that now have been made about Freud, of his methods, criticisms along the line saying that his ideas perhaps will tell you a great deal about him and about his time. Mm. But going beyond that, maybe some questions about whether they how widely they apply. Mm. So I suppose that again, it leads to this question that for someone who is trying to apply reasoning to a particular problem and spending time sincerely trying to puzzle things out, how, though, at the end of the day, you determine whether that's, you know, whether you're right or not. I guess that's the sort of the baldest way to put it.
Yeah. It depends really on the nature of your inquiry. And one of the things about philosophy that distinguishes it from science, and that includes psychology, is it's not what we would call an empirical discipline. Freudianism is an empirical theory, and that's why the criticisms of Freud on empirical grounds are very telling criticisms, because Freud never produced the kind of evidence necessary to justify his claims. For example, notoriously, his theory about psychosexual development in the child, you know, he claims there's an Oedipus complex. He claims that the boy desires to have sex with the mother and fears castration by the father. No evidence is ever given for that. And a modern-day developmental psychologist would want to actually do some empirical investigation. Freud would always claim that he discovered this in clinical sessions, but of course that's not a very reliable way to find out, partly because the patients that he had were very suggestible and would conform to the theories he put to them. And I think those ideas have been undermined, basically, by developmental psychologists. But philosophy is really different, because it isn't really an empirical subject where you'd found out that you're right by assembling data. It's what we think of as a conceptual subject, usually called a priori, as the label for it. So you're trying to figure things out and give arguments for things based on things everybody already knows. So to go back to the example I gave before, do I now know that there's a cup of coffee in front of me? In ordinary life, we think that I know there's a cup of coffee in front of me. After all, somebody just gave it to me and I was drinking it, and so on. The skeptical argument the philosopher gives is, but look, couldn't I be hallucinating a cup of coffee in front of me? Couldn't I be dreaming that there's one there? If that's true, those are possibilities. There's a conceptual problem, because how can I know something which could be false? So it's an argument that says, I assert that I know there's a cup of coffee there, but I also have to agree that I could be wrong about that. So is it consistent to say, I know there's a cup of coffee there, but I could be wrong about it? And it sounds like there's an inconsistency in that assertion, because the possibility of fallibility undermines the seeming necessity for certainty when I know something. So if you say I've got a good justification for believing there's a cup of coffee there, and then at the same time I say, and yet I might be wrong about it, that sounds like it's not a consistent thing to say. So that's the way philosophy will proceed by those kinds of arguments about things. So they're not arguments which could be resolved by appealing to empirical data. They're sort of conceptual arguments. And much of philosophy really is like that. It's to do with more conceptual arguments.
We're about at our midpoint here in this hour of focus. Again, our guest is Colin McGinn. He's professor of philosophy at the University of Miami, here to give a talk on the campus. And if you have questions, you can call in 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we do have some other folks who want to get into the conversation. Next, we'll talk with someone in Indiana on our toll free line. Line 4. Hello.
Hello. I was interested when we were talking about how you got into philosophy. Mm. Took me back to school. I started out in physics and notes, and I said, well, this is mathematics. And I went into mathematics, and I said, wait a minute, this is really logic. And
yeah.
God knows it belongs in philosophy.
Yeah.
And on the way I was. I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions. You mentioned about philosophy of science.
Mm.
I wanted to throw out some names that were familiar to me at the time I was studying. And I wonder if there's still names that are known in the literature or referred to, perhaps. One fellow was named Michael Scriven. He was from Australia.
Yes.
Tall fellow, extremely blonde hair, and he was down at IU for a while.
Yeah.
He and Norwood Russell Hansen started
right.
it.
Right.
History and Logic and Science, and
yeah.
that's where I made my mistake. I got caught in the academic wars, and I was on the wrong side, and fellowships just disappeared right and left. It was interesting to see that go on, and I decided, well, this is bad. I'll go to the business world. God, that's 10 times worse than the academic world. But anyway, I wonder where you stand on in philosophy of mathematics, formalism versus intuitionism or whatever. And do people still refer to the Principia Mathematica all the time like they used to back in my day?
Mm.
And
yes.
I think that's enough,
yes.
really. And the thing about metaphysics, about the metaphysics, and your thing about New Ageism, it's not only true in the bookstores, it's when someone says, what did you study in college? I said, well, one of the things is metaphysics.
Yeah.
All of a sudden you got beads thrown at you.
That's right. That's right.
Well,
you're an unusual caller because you do actually know quite a bit about philosophy.
And I've kept it up.
Yeah, you know the names and you know the
yeah,
topics.
Sure.
And those people, I would say, Hansen and Scriven, those are names which really date back to a little earlier than I went into graduate school.
Uh-huh.
They're still known. I wouldn't say that they are as central and discussed as they were
yeah.
back in those days, but I think they're recognized as important people.
Oh, good.
And
okay.
And Principia Mathematica is always referred to, and Russell is always regarded
yes.
as a major
yes.
figure, and
yeah.
Frege and Wittgenstein and Carnap
yeah.
and
yeah.
you know Quine later on. These are the main people, and philosophy of mathematics is a thriving discipline, and you mentioned formalism and intuitionism. There's also Platonism. So there's a lot of discussion about Platonism, which is the idea that mathematical entities exist outside space and time and are
yeah.
special abstract things. So all those subjects, I think, are very current still, and the people you mention are very much in the tradition that's continuing. And to go back to the very first question that I was discussing, they're not to do with people's ordinary life very much. They're to do with these more general abstract questions.
Yeah.
And so they don't appeal to people who don't have strong intellectual interests. But anybody interested in physics and mathematics, as you were, is going to naturally move into the issues in philosophy of physics. You know, they're just bound up with it. And issues, if you're a mathematician, you're going to start wondering, well, what are these things I call numbers? And
yeah.
you start to worry about those things. So philosophy isn't just something that philosophers just conjure up from nowhere. It arises completely naturally from knowledge of and immersion in any field, such as physics, such as mathematics, or biology, or anything. It's something which anybody in those areas would naturally have an interest in and should have an informed opinion about.
Yes. One thing I think I'll just leave this because this is something that's bothered me ever since I came across it. You knew about the mathematician Ramanujan?
Yes.
In India. Okay, I'm trying to remember who the British theorist, the numbers, was.
Hardy.
Okay, yeah, Hardy. I knew it was an H. I had Hardwood.
Hardy, yeah.
I remember him saying, it threw these things at him, and he looked at him, and he said, they've got to be right. They're too beautiful to be wrong.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Ever since then, I thought, they're all Platonist, you know? And I, since then, I decided that's where I'll go, too. Thanks a lot. It's been very interesting. It's nice.
It's a pleasure.
David has excellent people, but it's nice to see somebody in your own field and just drop through and stuff like that. Too bad I couldn't get over there and see that talk.
Well, I'm glad for your question.
Here.
All right.
Good
well,
luck.
Thanks for the call. Again, we're
Bye.
A little bit past the midpoint here. Our guest, Colin McGinn, he is visiting the campus. He'll be giving a talk. This is a talk in the MillerCom series. It's also the Philosophy Annual Public Lecture, Disgust and Death. His talk this afternoon at 4 at the Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum on the campus. It's open to the public. Anybody who is interested is certainly welcome to attend. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. So as a philosopher, what is it about disgust that interests you?
Well, the main thing that interested me was how puzzling disgust is. I think you mentioned at the beginning the very wide variety of things that we find disgusting. Mm. And it is indeed extremely various, heterogeneous collection of things. You know, and one thing perhaps I should say at this point is that, you know, to mention these subjects is people find sometimes a little disturbing, but I'll have to mention a few of them. Perhaps the most disgusting thing to almost everybody is rotting corpses or rotting flesh. Especially human bodies rotting, the smell, the look, the appearance of them, perhaps the touch of them. Feces are generally found disgusting by humans. Various bodily secretions are found disgusting, such as mucus, earwax and so forth, blood and so on. Wounds of various kinds are found disgusting. But also, of course, we find certain animal species disgusting. So some people find rats very disgusting or snakes. Certainly people find certain insects disgusting. Worms definitely are. So there's a fairly wide range of things, and you would wonder what integrates all these together. I mean, what is it that they all have in common which makes them all evoke in us that emotion of disgust that David described at the beginning, that face that we have. And it's a complex emotion because it seems very visceral and primitive. On the other hand, it seems quite intellectual, and it's an interesting fact, very interesting fact, that animals and young children don't feel disgust. So it seems to be an emotion that comes into existence at a certain conceptual level. And so it's a real challenge to try to find out what a philosopher would call the analysis of disgust. What are the necessary and sufficient conditions for something to be disgusting? So that's really what interested me initially in the subject. Then it broadened out into other areas, but that was what brought me to the subject originally.
Yeah. Well, there, I suppose, the connection with death, in some senses, would seem a natural one. I suppose one could say, well, if the reason that we seem disgusted by, say, decomposing corpses is because when we look at that decomposing corpse, at some level we have to say, sooner or later, that's going to be us.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. So that's a good thought to have. When you focus on that case in particular, the rotting corpses, that seems like a very natural thought to have. Now you've got to ask yourself about the feces. You know, when you look upon the feces, is that something that makes you think about that will be me dead? Well, apparently not.
No, not really.
It doesn't work. So all the animal species, why do you, rats, you know, worms, why does it make... So you wonder how to fit those together. But it's a good insight, a good initial insight to think about disgust in relation to death. An equally good and attractive way to think is, seemingly the opposite side of things, is disgusting things have to do with life, not death. So life processes seem disgusting, digestion in particular, blood, secretions and so on. So things, birth, things having to do with life, the process of life, they seem disgusting. So we've got these two things together. Life processes seem disgusting. Death processes seem disgusting. So what should we say about this? And it's a difficult issue. But let's notice a couple of problems with both of those two ideas, though. One point is, I think this is a very interesting point, skeletons are not very disgusting to us, pure skeletons. Of course, when we see a skeleton, it reminds us we're going to die, right? Also, if you're at the bedside of a person who dies and they go from living to dead, You don't have the emotion of disgust, even though that will remind you that you're going to die too. So that doesn't quite do it, right? The reminding you of death idea. It sounds on the right lines, but it sounds a little off. Similarly with life, it's not true that every life process is disgusting. Internal organs of the body, bodily fluids, those are reproduction, maybe they're found disgusting. But the movement of an animal is not disgusting. The movement of a tiger, for example, or the movement of a human being, that's a life process, movement, seeking of things, that's not disgusting. So neither of these seems to work. I think that the right way to go is you need another category of what I would call life in death and death in life. So in the corpse question, what we find there is that when the corpse is decomposing, that's actually a form of life thriving because that's the bacteria coming up. So there's death is part of the life process, of course, in general. So organisms live and they die. So part of the biological world is the process of moving from living to dead. And some of these other things that talk about the feces again, it's part of a life process. It's the eating, the digesting, and the inevitable excretion of the waste products. But there's a death side of that too, actually, because when you eat things, you always eat organic things. Sometimes they're vegetable, sometimes they're animal. So you kill things when you eat them. So there's a death involved in that too. So I think there's a much more complex and subtle interrelationship of life and death concepts involved in the disgusting stimulus. Another very striking point about disgust is it seems to apply only within the biological world and not to inorganic things. So you can't be disgusted by minerals or by machines. So if you take, say, a motor car, we find bodily fluids quite disgusting. We don't find gasoline in a car disgusting or oil in a car disgusting. You see, now it's odd, right? Because you think, well, look, it's a fluid, and why? What's the difference between the blood and the gasoline? You know, they're both essential for the functioning of the thing, because the emotion of disgust is focused on the biological process, which I think it should be thought of as the life in death, death in life process. So those two things brought together in a rather incongruous way.
Do you have any sympathy for somebody who might say something like that? Maybe one basic impulse that humans beings have is to try by whatever means they can to transcend the physical aspects of our nature. And the thing about life is it's messy. Mm-hmm. It's yes. Really messy.
Now,
and, you know, and so maybe that's part of what's going on is we're trying to separate ourselves from the messiness of being alive.
A very good insight, David. Yes, that's what my talk this afternoon is about. It's about the dual nature that we have as messy biological beings who are up to our neck in filth and sordid substances. And yet, on the other hand, of course, we're beings with minds, intellects, souls, as some would have, which transcend our biological nature. And my view is that the human condition is to be that dual, incongruous being that we are. And we differ from other animals because we can recognize our biological messy being. The concept of dirt, you see, we have very strongly. An animal does not have the concept of dirt. They don't have that. Mm-hmm. They may have the concept of the poisonous, you know, but the concept of dirt is a very specific human concept too. So I think that human life is very much an attempt to transcend our biological origins, our biological nature. Of course, we can't transcend it. We can't get away from it. We have to accept it. It's not something we find it easy to accept. Mm-hmm. So human life is structured around a biological nature, which, of course, we had no say in. And we didn't choose to have bodies of the kind that we have. We inherited them from the evolutionary process. But at some point in evolution threw up beings like us who have an aesthetic sense, thoughts about life and death, sensibilities toward things, weak stomachs about various things, which other animals don't worry about, anuses at all. You know, nothing about the anus worries a cat or a dog. Humans, oh dear, you know, then we we throw up our hands in despair. So I think the human life can be seen as an attempt to negotiate the disgust we naturally feel at our own biological constitution.
And how do you bring into this an idea like spiritual pollution or ritual uncleanliness?
It's interesting because there are two notions of disgust, and sometimes when you talk about it, people go from one to the other. One is what I would call physical disgust, which is the kind you feel against physical substances. In other words, a moral disgust, when somebody, so you say if somebody did something, for let's have a topical example, the molestation of children by Catholic priests, we kind of that's disgusting. We mean by that primarily morally disgusting. We mean, so we try to express our very strong moral condemnation by using the language of disgust, because that involves a reaction of rejection that we feel strongly towards something. So this idea of spiritual, there are two ways to think about it. Spiritual corruption or moral degradation. First of all, that's the use of disgust in this moral sense. But also, I think what's going on is a metaphorical extension of physical disgust into the psychological area. Mm-hmm. And it's really a rhetorical movement that we make in order to transfer the intensity of revulsion that we associate with just really physically disgusting things to another area. It's important to notice this, I think, because the mind itself cannot be physically disgusting. It doesn't ever create a reaction of physical disgust. So you don't actually get the vomit reflex evoked by what you call spiritual corruption. You do get the vomit reflex, of course, by feces, corpses, and so forth. So it's a metaphorical extended use of it, which is very interesting from the point of view of understanding moral language and so forth, and moral reactions. But I think it would be wrong to suppose that we're just dealing with the same emotional reaction in both cases.
We have several callers. I want to make sure we try to get them in the time that remains, and we're getting into about our last 15 minutes of the program. Our guest is Colin McGinn. He's professor of philosophy at the University of Miami and is here to talk about this very topic. This is a MillerCom event this afternoon on the U of I campus, and questions are welcome. We have several loaded up, and we'll just try to take them in the order they came, starting with line one and caller in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Yes.
I noticed, actually accidentally, that there's quite a bit of philosophy lectures now available on the Internet in podcast form from various universities around the country and around the world. And I was wanting to know, well, one, do you podcast? And I guess the second question would be, what kind of implications do you see in terms of having people, more in tune with what people are doing in philosophy? Mm.
I think this is a good question, actually. There were a few lectures that I've done, interviews I've done, which are on the web. They're mainly to do with atheism, because I sometimes get called upon to talk about atheism. I have a blog also, and I write about various subjects there. But you're right that there's quite a bit of philosophy now on the web. And I think what's nice about it is that it brings philosophy to people in a way that the other, mechanisms of culture haven't really succeeded in doing. You don't find anything on television about philosophy at all. You know, Charlie Rose, who does this, the most intellectual interview program on television, I don't think I ever saw in many years of watching Charlie Rose him interview a philosopher on there. He once interviewed Chomsky, who's a linguist but also a philosopher, and he began by saying, I don't know anything about philosophy, so let's just talk about politics. So the media is completely ignorant about philosophy, and, I will constantly read in the New York Times even some of their supposedly intellectual journalists who demonstrate total ignorance about philosophy and say the most silly things about it, often dismissive and silly things. So on the net, of course, it democratizes education and information so people can go on there and find what real philosophers have to say. And I think that philosophy, I find this with my students over many years, people are interested in philosophy. They want to know about it. They find the questions extremely interesting. You know, sometimes settling down with a philosophical book, it's a little difficult for people. They haven't got the time, but they go onto their computer, they see somebody talk. It's a live subject when you see somebody talk about it, and you find people interested. So I think that possibly in the future, the web might be a place where philosophy will find a more significant place in culture than it's had for maybe 50 years.
Yeah, I think you're right. I guess I was just wondering before I go are you seeing any tangible evidence of that, say, in your own academic environment? And thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
All right, we'll go on. Another caller. This is also someone in Urbana and line three. Hello.
Oh, hi, how are you? Yeah, philosophy is a very interesting subject to me. But I wonder if you can measure this disgust reflex, or whatever you call it, reflex,
yeah,
by what a society, like for instance, if you go to the like lesser developed countries, you'll notice that a lot of them don't have plumbing. So they usually have, it's like back in the early 1600s or something in the West, you had just threw your feces or your discharges out into the street.
Right.
or like you go to Rio de Janeiro or something like that, but you can measure it by how what is put away.
Mm.
Like people dress now because nudity is not acceptable.
Right.
And I don't know if it's nudity is considered disgusting or not. But also, when I was in the military, I sort of lost my vomit reflex by spending 15 months in a combat zone. So you sort of you don't have toilets and
yes,
people
yes.
get shot.
Yes.
And you see a lot of destruction. So you sort of become accustomed to that. So
yes.
You're not. And also, another example that, pushing this disgusting way would be burials and cremation.
Yeah.
And is that a measure? Is that how you guys think about that?
I think that's a very good measure of it,
mm-hmm.
because disgust is unlike fear. So what we our feelings about disgusting stimuli is we want to put them away, hide them away, so they don't affect us in a sensory way and certainly don't make any contact with our body, especially the mouth is the most sensitive area
mm-hmm.
there. So we don't flee disgusting things as we flee things we fear, but we want to hide them is the main thing we want to do. That's why we have privacy in various acts that we do, because we want these things to be hidden from each other.
Mm-hmm.
You also make another, I think, very good point about the seeming plasticity of the disgust reflex, where through habituation, it is possible for somebody to not feel the degree of disgust at something that they felt when they started out. You can imagine nurses must start out, with a lot of strong disgust, and then they have to, day in and day out, or doctors, day in and day out, they're dealing with the human body, and they have to negotiate that. What is very interesting, though, is there seems to be a limit on that. It's not as if people can just completely eliminate their disgust response and have no tendency to feel it. I think what actually happens is that people have the disgust response inwardly, but they learn to control their behavioral expression of that. So you don't find people just, after a lifetime of work, just finding it there to be nothing problematic at all about excrement. Nobody wants excrement smeared on them, no matter how familiar they may be with it. They manage to control and to some degree suppress their reaction. So that, I think, suggests some of the cultural side of disgust, that it's a cognitively driven emotion. But it's complex because it's not something that you can just eliminate completely. Some emotions just can go away when you become more educated about the subject matter. But it seems as if disgust, though it's got cultural variability and some plasticity, there's a sort of inner core of it which is very stubborn and doesn't really go away when people are habituated to things.
One other thing before I hang up. What about, this is maybe not the kind of subject you can discuss publicly, but what about sexual intimacy? Because people, when you're younger and you don't have intimacy, and then you get older, you get a little old, you get more intimate, you have more relationships, people will do things that, or they'll say they've done things, or they may actually do, or think things.
Yeah.
That would normally, in the context, be considered revulsive.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do that, but then over your life, you may start, maybe your mind the erotic element about that.
Right.
Could you discuss that if possible? Thank you.
It's a very good topic. It's not discussed as much as it should be because it's very taboo. And it's difficult to discuss in public without getting into issues that people find very uncomfortable. In the book I've been writing about it, I do directly address this kind of question. And there's no doubt at all, I think, that there's an ambivalence in our relationship to sexual contact, because we don't normally do not want to be in contact with other people's bodies and other people's fluids and so forth. And it's only in certain contexts, when there's strong sexual attraction, that we can overcome that natural antipathy. And I think sexual emotions really are a sort of very uneasy and subtle combination of disgust reactions, attraction reactions, and so forth. And the whole subject, I think, is immensely interesting and complicated, and certainly one that people should try to think about, even if it's difficult to discuss.
Well, this, I think to me this gets it back to what is an interesting question about to what extent what we're talking about is something that is truly inborn, and you can make the argument that it would be, for survival, it maybe would be a good thing for people to have an innate aversion to rotting organic material. Maybe it'd be a good thing if you'd say that and say, I don't want to go near that. But at some point, you do have to ask, when does culture come into this?
Mm-hmm.
Because, because as you pointed out, things that people find maybe immediately disgusting, if if circumstances force you to, you can come to some kind of accommodation.
Yeah. Or you might just change your views about it and find things not disgusting that you thought were disgusting before. You wouldn't have to be forced, but yeah, but you do. Darwin's theory of disgust was sometimes called the toxicity theory. It's the idea that we find disgusting anything which is potentially toxic. And it fits certain cases, like rotting flesh is liable to be toxic, but it doesn't fit many cases. There are many things which are poisonous and toxic which we don't find disgusting. Certain chemicals, for example, but they're toxic. Other things we find disgusting which are in no way toxic. So, you know, it's like rats are not toxic, or worms are not toxic, but we find them disgusting. So it's not necessary and it's not sufficient. But it does seem very plausible to think that was the evolutionary foundation of the disgust response, which then was overlaid with more cultural cognitive elements. So the emotion has got this combination of an ancient brute biological reaction to the toxic, but then it's become combined with these much more cognitive ideas about life and death, mortality, what a human being is, the fact that we have knowledge that we will die and so forth. And all of that really comes together in the emotion that we think of as disgust. Mm.
We have some other callers, and we'll have a couple of emails. We'll see if I can get as much as I can in about the 5 minutes we have left. Next, we'll go to, I believe, a caller in Belgium on line four.
Belgium.
Hello. Not the country, but it's a town.
Okay. It's a town.
It's not far away from here. Yes, go ahead.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I'd like to bring in a topic of disgust and our own physical health. And I'm not sure that you even have spoken about it, though Mr. Inge here just basically mentioned it. As we evolved through the eons, we were in a lot of disgusting things over a period of things, and our bodies developed an immune system to fight these things. Now, in the developed world, mothers won't let their children touch dirt. There's lots of things we find disgusting that were very much just natural things we dealt with historically, okay? And now all of a sudden we develop diseases like asthma and diabetes and stuff, and a lot of these diseases are autoimmune diseases. Well, we take away this disgusting stuff that our body's used to fighting, and we don't fight it anymore. Now they say, well, we got to fight something, so we're going to just start going after our own bodies. Could disgust actually have an effect on how healthy we are?
I think in its origin it probably evolved through a health, keeping the animal well and not sick, because of course when an animal has to eat, and it should eat some things and not others. But with animals, of course, the disgust, the pattern of behavior is very unlike ours, particularly in regard, say, to feces. You know, that animals don't have such a horror of feces that we do. So it's difficult to see that the emotion that we have as it now exists can be reduced to that health-related question. But it seems to me extremely likely that it must have arisen originally from that, and then it was extended from that central case outwards into other areas and became far more cognitive. That's the way I think of it.
All right. I'll try to get one more caller here. I want to thank the last. We'll go to Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
To go back to the cup of coffee.
Oh, yeah.
That seems like, well, to me, I'm a biologist, and to me that's a probabilistic question,
yeah.
And that we are empiricists in the way we live.
Yeah.
And so I've got experience, and I know that that's usually a cup of coffee, therefore I'm going to label it a cup of coffee and act on it as if it is a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
So, to me, it's not a philosophical question. I'm acting on the probability that that's what that is. And that's the same thing that when I talk to religious friends of mine and they talk about evolution, and I say, well, and I try to say it's our best guess and it's based on, there's so much use in having that paradigm.
Yeah.
So it doesn't seem like a philosophical question.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure why you say it's not a philosophical question, because the answer you gave was a philosophical answer, because you said it's based on probability. So what you're saying was, well, in the past, when I've judged that there was a cup of coffee there, I've confirmed that subsequently by other experiences. I haven't determined that it was a dream and so forth later on. So I've made an inference from the past. That's what we call inductive inference. That raises questions in itself, philosophical, which is how do you move from the fact that something in the past has been so to the fact that it will be so in the future. But notice one thing about the answer that you gave there. Normally, if you said to me, are you certain there's a cup of coffee in front of you? I'd say, yes, I'm certain of it. Like, what do you have in mind? Why shouldn't I be certain of it? If I just came out and said, there's probably a cup of coffee in front of me now, you'd think, why are you saying that? You think that you've been hallucinating a lot recently, or there's a lot of fake coffee cups around. I say, no, not at all. Normally, we think that we are certain about certain things. For example, we think we're certain we have a body. Now, Descartes comes along and says, well, you're certain you have a body, but look, isn't it logically possible that you're a disembodied brain, you know, and deceived by the evil demon and so forth? So you can't really be certain of that. That's where it gets philosophical, because now we've got to think about whether our ordinary judgments that certain things are certain are actually wrong, and these things are nothing is certain. That's why Descartes argued that. Actually, nothing is certain except your own existence. Because in ordinary common sense, we think various things are certain, and Descartes is arguing to us philosophically that those things are not certain. So that's why it's philosophical. And a response to it might be to say, look, we have to change our notion of certainty, or we have to adopt a fallibilistic or probabilistic model where we only ever say things like, it's only probable that there's a cup of coffee in front of me. It's only probable that I have a body. And we have to develop a notion of probability that makes sense of that. So I think we're doing philosophy as soon as we start to move in those directions.
I'm very sorry to say we're going to have to stop. One thing that is certain is that it's the end of the hour and we have to leave it there. However, for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest this morning, Colin McGinn, he's professor of philosophy at the University of Miami. He'll be speaking on the topic disgust and death this afternoon on the U of I campus, 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory. This is a MillerCom event. It's also the Philosophy Annual Public Lecture. And it is free and open to the public. And anybody who is interested to attend should feel welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. Good questions from the audience.